Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
On the evening of January 2nd, 1999, two sisters stood on their street in Mesa, Arizona, waiting for the ice cream truck. The older girl, who was 11, had two quarters clutched in her hand. Her little sister, who was 9, got cold and ran inside, just for a minute. When she came back out, the bike her sister had been sitting on was lying in the road, one wheel still slowly spinning. The two quarters were on the pavement nearby, and Mikkel Biggs was gone. The whole thing happened in about 90 seconds. Search dogs would later follow her scent a few feet from that spot and then lose it completely. Police collected over 800 pieces of evidence and chased more than 10,000 tips, but nearly three decades later, Mikkel has never been found. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Mikkel Biggs. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. This week's episode is the kind of disappearance that your parents warn you about when you're a kid.
Yeah, this sounds absolutely terrifying. It also sounds like a scene from a movie.
Oh, 100%. Like the wheel spinning.
Yeah.
Like, it's insane. I mean, it does. It seems fake or like impossible, because how can someone be there one moment and just gone the next without anyone seeing anything?
Yeah. I mean, this is, I'm assuming, middle of the day, quiet neighborhood.
Like, yeah. Like, kids were out playing, you know, it's like going into the early evening, but it's still daylight. Yeah, it's absolutely insane. It's a living nightmare, really, and it's one that the Biggs family has been living through for the past 27 years. Before we get into it, we've had a few folks join us over on Patreon, so we'd like to take a moment to give them a shout out. Thank you to Ellie and Lisa S. We really appreciate your support.
Thank you both so much.
As a reminder, if you'd like to get our episodes ad-free and sometimes early, you can join us over on Patreon at any level, starting at just $2 a month. You'll also get a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. So now let's get into the story of Mikkel Biggs. Mikkel Diane Biggs was born on May 31st, 1987, to Darian and Tracy Biggs. She was the oldest of four kids and grew up in Mesa, Arizona. The Biggs family was part of the area's Latter-day Saints community, and the Mormon church was a big part of their lives. Mikkel was a sweet, shy, bookish kid. Her mom, Tracy, described her to Dateline as, quote, very kind and loving, very sweet. And she called her, quote, big, big bookworm, end quote, who was in a book club. She played the clarinet in the school band, and she loved to sing. She was a straight-A student, she was on the honor roll, and she'd been taking art classes since she was about 4 years old, because her dream since then was to become an animator for Disney.
Wow, that's a big dream.
Yeah. Mikkel was close with her little sister Kimber, who was 2 years younger. So Kimber was about 9, Mikkel was about 11. They had two other siblings. I want to say her brother was about 4. When all of this was happening, and then they had another baby sister, I think it was. So there was a little bit of an age gap there between the first two and the second two kids. So Mikkel and Kimber were very close.
Got it.
The two played outside together all the time, which is exactly what they were doing on January 2nd, 1999, making 9-year-old Kimber the last person who saw Mikkel. Perhaps that's why, all these years later, Kimber is the person who has fought hardest to keep her sister's case alive. January 2nd was a Saturday, and it was the tail end of the holiday break. Mikkel and Kimber were outside taking turns riding the bike that Kimber had just gotten for Christmas. Sometime around 6 o'clock, Mikkel and Kimber were out in front of the house near the corner of El Moro and Toltec when they heard the sweet siren song of an ice cream truck. Mikkel ran back home and begged her mom for 50 cents to buy a popsicle. Her mother gave her 2 quarters and she ran back out to wait for the truck. The girls waited and waited, but the music didn't seem to be getting any closer. Mikkel was still determined, but Kimber was getting impatient and a little cold. The sun was starting to set and the desert air was getting chilly. She said that she wanted to go back in, but Mikkel told her she was going to stay and wait. When Kimber got back to the house, which was right there, she told her mom the ice cream man still hadn't come. Since it was getting close to dinner time anyway, Tracy told her to just go back out and tell Mikkel it was time to come home. So that's what Kimber did. She went back out, and in the time it took her to walk in, say a few words to her mom, and walk back out, between 60 and 90 seconds, something unimaginable happened. Instead of seeing her sister riding circles on her bike waiting for the ice cream man, she found the bike lying in the middle of the road. One wheel was still spinning. The 2 quarters Mikkel had been holding were on the ground next to it, but Mikkel was nowhere to be found.
I mean, this is just absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, it's every parent's worst case scenario, because this isn't a case of negligence. You know, nobody like left her alone for an hour. It was 90 seconds on a quiet residential street with her mom right inside the house. But that's all it took. Of course, Kimber didn't quite understand the gravity of the situation immediately. Her first instinct was that Mikkel was playing a trick on her. She figured that her big sister was hiding and was going to jump out and scare her. So she actually looked around a little bit before, like, panic started to set in. But when Mikkel didn't pop out from behind anything, Kimber went and got her mom. Tracy came out, looked around, checked with neighbors, and then she called a friend who alerted their church, and then she called the police. Now, I know it always seems weird when other people are called before the police, but
this is a Mormon community.
Exactly.
Of course, the first thing that they do is call their church.
Yeah, and it really does make sense in the situation, because by the time the police got there, there were already something like 50 or 60 people from the family's congregation out combing the neighborhood.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, they really sprung into action fast. In a lot of cases that we cover, things often move slowly at the start, but that was not the problem here. The response was massive and immediate, both from police and all of these, you know, congregation members and neighbors and just everybody.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. It wasn't just that the timeline of when she went missing was so tight, literally 90 seconds. But they started looking for her almost immediately. They knew exactly where she went missing. It wasn't like, you know, other cases that we've covered, like Debbie Sasson, where she went missing on her way home from school. So, right. Like, we just knew she went missing somewhere between her school and her house.
Right.
Like, we knew the exact spot on the street from where she went missing. And people were out looking for her instantly. Mikkel's dad, Darian, wasn't home when it happened. He got Paige to call home, and Tracy told him that their daughter was gone. He raced back to join in the search. Thankfully, police didn't mess around. They didn't treat Mikkel's disappearance as a runaway or a kid hiding out at a friend's house. Almost right away, they classified it as a suspicious disappearance and threw everything they had at it. They did door-to-door interviews, searched on foot, and had helicopters in the air that very night.
Wow, that is a fast response.
The Arizona Republic has called this the most intense investigation in the Mesa Police Department's history. Over the course of this case, police collected more than 800 pieces of evidence and fielded more than 10,000 tips. Detectives have said it's, if not the largest, then one of the largest missing persons investigations in Arizona history. That was, of course, before the Nancy Guthrie case likely took that title. In just the first week of Mikkel's investigation, as many as 500 volunteers a night were out distributing flyers. They papered something like 44 square miles of the East Valley. Eventually, with help from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, hundreds of thousands of flyers went out in the mail. Police interviewed around 20 sex offenders living in the area. They followed up on tips by interviewing, and this is not an exaggeration, close to 500 psychics.
500 psychics?
Yeah. Which I don't even want to get into because, like, the amount of time that that must have taken.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. But let's just say they're covering all of the bases.
Okay.
They searched something like 35 abandoned mine shafts out in the Santan Mountains. They tracked down essentially every ice cream vendor in the state of Arizona. About a week in, they dug up a patch of freshly turned earth outside of Mesa that somebody had reported as a possible grave, but there was nothing there. They set up roadblocks to question people who regularly drove in the area. They even hypnotized two witnesses to try to shake loose any details that they may have.
Damn. That's, I mean, rather unorthodox methods, but I mean, hey, why not?
Yeah. Now, in addition to the psychics, they also brought in dogs to track Mikkel's scent. The dogs followed it just a few feet away from where the bike was lying and then lost it. The scent just stopped. And to investigators, that meant one thing. Mikkel didn't walk away and she wasn't carried off down the street. She was put into a vehicle almost exactly where the bike fell, which makes sense considering that there weren't any witnesses who actually saw anything.
Yeah, it is interesting though, because it happened so fast and it was so spontaneous,
mm-hmm.
these people or this person had to have been just sitting in a car or a van or whatever, watching these girls.
Right.
Just waiting for the opportunity.
Yeah, like I can't imagine that they were just driving by.
No, like, so I'm actually kind of surprised that no witnesses said that they saw a van or a car or something that was out of the ordinary parked in the neighborhood. Same thing with her sister. Like, I'm surprised that she didn't notice that there was a car idling down the street.
Yeah. So there was one vehicle that got a lot of early attention. It was a copper tan-colored Jeep that had been seen near El Moro and Toltec around the time Mikkel vanished. And I think that that did stand out because it wasn't like a neighbor's car.
Right.
You know? And I don't know who gave that tip, if that came from Kimber or a neighbor or another kid or, you know, whatever. I don't know where that came from. But that is in the very early articles on this case. So police, though, did eventually track down that driver and ruled him out. He'd been in the area, but hadn't seen anything unusual. So, you know, again, this was reported on early, but without a lot of details as to, like, why the driver was ruled out.
Yeah. Interesting. So then what does that leave? Let's say there was no car. Maybe it was a neighbor that grabbed her and dragged her into his house.
Yeah, and that's another thing. Though, you would think that if it was a neighbor who grabbed her and dragged her into their house, that the dogs would have followed the scent to a house as opposed to just losing it in the street.
Right.
But of course, you know, scent dogs aren't infallible either.
Sure.
So it's hard to say, you know. And that was her neighborhood, too. So you would think her scent would kind of be all over it.
Yeah.
People Magazine Investigates did a really good episode on Mikkel's case. They were able to interview Mikkel's parents and her sister, Kimber. One thing they didn't shy away from was how, while police were out searching for Jeeps and witnesses, they were also looking right back at home, specifically at Darian, Mikkel's father. Your body is already sending you signals, and for me, the signals are loud. The afternoon crashes, the plateau at the gym, the sleep issues that won't resolve. Jevity helps you look under the hood and actually address them. Jevity is the first all-in-one precision health membership that goes beyond the traditional healthcare system, which is designed to react, not to prevent. You go in once a year, get a basic panel, and here, everything looks fine. But fine is a low bar. It means nothing is critically wrong right now. Not that something isn't coming around the corner. heart disease, metabolic dysfunction, hormonal decline, these don't show up overnight. They develop quietly, sometimes for years, while the system tells you that you're healthy. With your Jivity membership, you get a dedicated three-person care team, including a longevity specialist and clinician to guide your health journey. You get full body testing beyond blood work, including gut microbiome analysis, advanced genetic testing, cancer screening, and more. Right now, we're offering our listeners 20% off your purchase if you go to our link, gojevity.com/gone, and use code ATTWG. That's gojevity.com, gojevity.com/gone to get 20% off your purchase with promo code ATTWG. The best summer pieces are the ones you end up wearing on repeat. They're comfortable, versatile, and somehow right for almost every occasion. That's why I love Quince. I'm actually wearing a pair of their 100% European linen pants right now as I'm recording this. They're perfect for a hot day like this, where I can still look put together and stay cool. But Quince is more than clothing. They have 14-karat gold jewelry that adds a subtle finishing touch, whether it's simple hoops or delicate chains. They make even the most effortless outfit feel intentional. Quince also offers elevated essentials for your home, from bedding and bath to kitchen essentials and furniture. And everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for exceptional quality, not brand markup. So if you want to make your summer wardrobe feel easier, go to quince.com/ATTWG for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/ATTWG for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ATTWG. You should never have to choose between a home that looks great and one that's actually livable. Between pets, kids, spills, some of which are done by my kids, many of which are done by me, the new Ruggable All-in-One Rug delivers premium design with the peace of mind of being machine washable, stain resistant, and non-slip. I came to the conclusion long ago that I need machine washable rugs in my home. And Ruggable has the most beautiful designs, whether it's vintage-inspired, neutral, modern, whatever your style is, you will find it at Ruggable. They're stain-resistant for everyday spills, but they have a high-quality look and feel. And most importantly, they're durable and built for your life. Refresh your home at Ruggable.com. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with promo code ATTWG at Ruggable.com. That's Ruggable.com and use code ATTWG at checkout. Other than the fact that police have to look at the parents in any missing child case, there were a couple things that initially drew attention to Darian. For one, when Mikkel disappeared, he said he was at work, which was where he was supposed to be at that time. But it later came out that he was actually at a friend's house.
Interesting.
Yeah, but of course, it wasn't actually a friend.
Mm.
It was his mistress.
Gotcha.
Now, what I find interesting is that this fact is briefly mentioned in early reporting. But Darian said that he had told Tracy about the affair back in November.
Okay.
But if your wife already knows, why are you lying to the police about it when your daughter is missing?
Right.
I mean, I get lying to the police, which, again, you know, definitely not something you should lie to the police about when your daughter's missing. But I get the impulse to do that because you don't want your wife and your family to find out.
But if they already knew,
but they already know, yeah, then you're just lying to the police in the middle of an investigation like this.
Yeah. And then I guess it probably came out when they went to check his alibi and it turned out that he wasn't at work.
Well, yeah, because they called his work and they're like, oh, no, he left at like 2:30.
Right. So then he needed the mistress to verify his alibi.
Exactly. So then they had to go interview her. The whole thing was a mess. And again, very suspicious, you know?
Well, maybe he just didn't want it out because he knew, like...
The church wouldn't approve?
Well, yeah, like, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, it would get out once he admitted to the police about it.
Right. But, like, I mean, he had to have known that they were going to verify he was at work.
Yeah.
And his work was good, because he worked for like a large company, like a large corporation, you know?
Right.
So he was, I'm sure he just called like HR, you know, his boss or whoever, and they just looked at the records.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh yeah, no, he was gone. Like, it's just so insane to me. And so, yeah, but nobody ever addressed that, like why he decided to lie or whatever, because it is something that has been talked about even recently. So whether or not the part about Tracy knowing about the affair is true, this does not appear to have been a casual fling. According to the People Magazine Investigates episode, Darian started bringing his kids around to his girlfriend's house.
Okay.
The implication to me was that he was possibly planning on leaving his wife and just, like, I don't know, having a family with this new lady and, like, wanted his kids to be used to her. Being the oldest, however, Mikkel didn't approve.
Sure.
And so police seem to think that Darian may have gotten rid of her in order to make the transition easier. So that was kind of like their working theory early on, because this guy's looking suspicious as hell.
Yeah.
Like I said, in the early articles on this, the affair is briefly mentioned. It's, from what I remember, it was mentioned in an article as like, you know, as the investigation went on, it came out that Mikkel's father was having an affair, but he had told his wife about it months before.
No, so it's okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know?
Yeah. Don't worry about that.
Yeah. And that was it. Like, there wasn't really a lot of ongoing talk from police about his alibi and, you know, how they were really, really looking at him as a suspect. But that's something that Darian talks about in the People Investigates episode, which came out just a few years ago. So he talks about that time a lot and how they were really, really going after him in the early days.
It's the only suspect they have at this point.
Yeah. Now, what we do see in the original reporting is the fact that 2 weeks after Mikkel's disappearance, Darian was asked to come down and take a polygraph test. In an article in the Arizona Republic from January 16th, 1999, Darian told reporters that the test came back inconclusive, but that he wasn't surprised, quote, because they told me I was too angry, end quote.
Okay.
And that part tracks, because even 25 or so years later, when he was talking about this in that episode, the anger he had was still very much apparent.
Anger at who? At the police?
At the police.
Oh, for digging so deeply into him?
Yeah. Because, you know, from his perspective, he's like, I didn't do anything to my daughter. You're wasting time on me.
Yeah, sure.
Which I get. But I also get why the police were spending a lot of time on him, you know?
Yeah.
It all looks very bad. And in that same Arizona Republic article, a, quote, police source said that, no, it wasn't inconclusive at all. He just failed.
Mm.
Though they didn't say, like, what questions he failed on or give any specifics.
Right.
At one point, Darian says that he literally flipped a table in an interrogation room.
Okay.
So, like, I don't know if that was during the polygraph, if that was just another time he was being questioned or what. But yeah, definitely a lot of anger. And Kimber later described her dad as an angry zombie during this time. Like, so, you know, everybody was a mess, which makes sense.
Yeah.
A reporter named Jim Walsh, who covered the case for years for the Arizona Republic, told 48 Hours that he thought the police looked at Darian so hard, partly because he's just a more reserved, less outwardly emotional kind of person. And that really fits in with Kimber's characterization as an angry zombie. But we've talked about this before. Like, the public and sometimes even the police expect grief to look a certain way. And especially when a parent doesn't perform the right way, people get suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
But again, he was doing a lot of suspicious shit, too. So it's like, I get it, you know?
Yeah.
Police surveilled and scrutinized Darian for about a year, but they eventually cleared him for a few reasons. One was the crime scene itself. The way the bike was lying in the road with the quarters on the ground nearby indicates that Mikkel was trying to get away from a person and was grabbed.
Mm-hmm.
Her father wouldn't have had to do that. He could have just rolled up and told her to get in the car.
Yeah.
The other thing was that he had picked up dinner for his girlfriend right around the time of Mikkel's disappearance. And police were able to confirm the purchase and didn't believe that it would have been physically possible for him to have gone out, gotten the dinner, abducted Mikkel from the street, and then have gotten back to his girlfriend's house and the amount of time that he had.
Mm-hmm.
He also presumably had no way of knowing that Mikkel was out in the street at that exact moment alone.
Right.
He had been at work all day, or, you know, at least half the day.
Yeah.
And, you know, half the day, and then had gone to see his mistress. Like, he hadn't been home at all that day. And he said that the last time he saw Mikkel was the night before when he put her to bed. I guess it sounds like he just left for work before she was up that morning. So while police did look at Darian for a while, there was another crime that would soon put a different name on law enforcement's radar. About 9 months after Mikkel vanished, in September 1999, a horrifying crime was committed against a woman who lived in the same neighborhood as the Biggs family. This woman, Susan Quinette, came home one evening only to find another neighbor by the name of D. Lee Blaylock hiding behind her refrigerator. He sexually assaulted her, beat her, choked her until she lost consciousness, and left her to die in a house fire.
Jesus.
Miraculously, she survived. According to People Investigates, she not only identified her attacker as D. Lee Blaylock, but said that she had an epiphany that he was the one who was responsible for Mikkel's disappearance.
Okay. How does she know this?
Again, she said it just came to her. Like, she was literally like half dead in the ambulance and was like, this is who did this. This is who took that girl. So who is D. Lee Blaylock? At the time of this attack, he was a 42-year-old married father of three who lived just a few doors down from Susan Quinette and in the same neighborhood as the Biggs. But he wasn't exactly a squeaky clean family man. Blaylock was a registered sex offender with a lengthy criminal history across several states. In 1985, he was convicted of sexually assaulting a child at knife point in Texas. And in 1989, he was convicted of unlawful imprisonment in Arizona and required to register as a sex offender. And it was this registration that had led his name to come up in the case before. He was one of the sex offenders originally interviewed by police just due to his proximity to Mikkel's house. He also popped up in front of news cameras at a vigil for Mikkel that took place 10 days after her disappearance. There, he appeared to simply be a concerned neighbor and is on camera saying, quote, "If you're my neighbor and I see you're living next to me and I see something suspicious going on, I guarantee you I'll be calling 911, end quote.
Putting on a show.
Yeah.
Mm.
And 9 months later, he attacks his neighbor.
Right.
And leaves her for dead.
Yeah.
But interestingly, according to Susan Quinette, she had been having problems with Blaylock for quite some time and had even called the police on him previously. Susan told reporters, quote, "He was coming up on me. He was drunk. He reeked of beer. He was putting his hands on me in my yard. I called the police. I said, the guy is creeping me out. He's stalking me. I've tried to tell his wife," end quote. Now, what's unclear is if that incident, when he came up to her in her yard, happened before or after Mikkel's disappearance.
Mm-hmm.
In either case, when police spoke with him back in January of 1999, Blaylock said that he was home in his garage drinking beer and watching football. His wife at the time and her sister backed up that alibi. Police actually searched his house that very night and didn't find anything. So early on, he had an alibi. There was no physical evidence and the investigation moved past him. But when Susan was attacked in September and said she believed Blaylock was also responsible for Mikkel's disappearance, police obviously circled back. They questioned him, but he didn't budge. He said he had nothing to do with Mikkel's disappearance. And then Susan did something that I have a hard time wrapping my mind around. According to People Investigates, she said that she would drop all of the charges against him for her crime if he just told police what he did with Mikkel.
Wow.
He not only sexually assaulted her and choked her until she lost consciousness, he broke a bone in her neck.
Jesus.
And Dee Blaylock was facing a lot of time for that crime. So, yes, I mean, obviously, admitting to kidnapping a child is not really going to work out well for you. He truly didn't have much to lose at that point. Because for him to get those charges against Susan dropped, I mean, really would have been a big deal. And then you would think he could have negotiated another deal.
Sure.
In relation to Mikkel.
To giving information, right.
Right. Yeah. That could have like potentially given him something, right? Yeah. But he wouldn't budge. He said that he had nothing to do with Mikkel's disappearance. But you can't necessarily take his word for it because he also said he wasn't the one who attacked Susan. He stood up in court and said he had a good life with a wife and kids. So, you know, why would he throw it all away? But luckily, it didn't end up being a he said, she said kind of thing. He went on trial for Susan's attack, and it turns out there was DNA. Blaylock's DNA was found on Susan's breast, and her DNA was found inside of his underwear. Blaylock was found guilty and was sentenced to 187 years in prison.
Damn.
That's what I mean when I say he was facing some serious time. 187 years.
Right, but who knows how, like, yes, 187 years, obviously it's a life sentence, but kidnapping and murdering a child probably has a more severe sentence or equal.
Right, right. But like, again, I go back to, you know, he probably could have worked out a deal because I think her parents just would have wanted to know, you know?
Yeah.
But it's all speculation. But that's not where Dee Blaylock's involvement in this case ended. After he went to prison, his alibi for the night of Mikkel's disappearance fell apart. His ex-wife and his former sister-in-law, the two people who had said he was home all evening, recanted their stories. The lead detective, Paul Seip, told Dateline that they walked back their original statements and said that Blaylock had actually been gone that night, sometime between roughly 5:30 and 7:30 in the evening, which is exactly the window in which Mikkel was taken. Police have also said that Blaylock allegedly made statements while he was incarcerated that tied him back to this case. A Mesa sergeant described it to People as an alleged jailhouse confession. But we have to really go heavy on the alleged because while Blaylock has said things over the years, he hasn't really said anything concrete about Mikkel's disappearance, nothing that anybody was really able to act on. Mikkel's parents, Darren and Tracy, exchanged letters for years with Blaylock in prison and even visited him, trying to get answers. He toyed with them for a while, but it seems as though he was just trying to use the situation to get better perks in prison. Despite the fact that Blaylock hasn't given any real information regarding Mikkel and that he will almost certainly die in prison regardless, police still think he's the key to this case.
Well, it would make sense, right? So we're talking, you know, like I said before, none of the witnesses reported anything unusual aside from that Jeep that was tracked down. That lead was tracked down
and ruled out.
So it's very likely he was observing them from his garage, you know, where his wife and sister-in-law said that he was, and then when the opportunity was there, snatched her, probably put her in a car, and drove her somewhere, and then did something.
Right.
We're talking about, you know, you said they recanted and said that he was gone between 5:30 and 7:30. I mean, that's enough time to take her someplace and do horrible things and then come back.
Yeah. In January 2024, an ABC 15 reporter asked the lead detective point blank whether he was still a person of interest. And Detective Paul Sipes said, quote, "I would say he is the person of interest," end quote. Police have even laid out their working theory of what happened, which is basically exactly what you said. Detective Sipe told Dateline that they believe Blaylock left his house shortly before the kidnapping, saw Mikkel out there alone because Kimber had just gone inside, and that it was, in his words, quote, kind of a crime of opportunity, end quote. They believe that after he took her and left the neighborhood, he assaulted her and killed her. But to me, the big question is, where did he take her without his wife and sister-in-law noticing? And how did he get rid of Mikkel so completely, so quickly? The only answer I have is that Kimber has talked about how Blaylock had a trailer on his property and that by the time police were in a position to search it, it was gone.
Hmm. Interesting.
So that could have potentially held some answers, but we'll never know. While a lot of people believe that Blaylock is the guy who did this and he's not just, you know, talking and saying things, not everyone is positive. Kimber has said publicly in recent years that she believes he's probably responsible, but it doesn't seem that even she's 100% convinced. And after looking into the case for this episode, neither am I. Yes, he's a good suspect, and yes, he's done terrible things, but something else from the early newspaper articles on Mikkel's case keeps bothering me. On Christmas Day, 1998, just 8 days before Mikkel's disappearance, another 11-year-old girl was attacked less than a mile away. A man lured the girl behind an apartment complex and tried to force her to perform oral sex on him. She escaped before she did and later told police that he was grimy and appeared to be transient. He was described in the original article as a white male with blonde hair. He's about 5'10", 140 pounds, with acne scars and decayed front teeth. He wore jeans, a white t-shirt, and a waist-length army coat. Some witnesses said he was seen with another transient or a woman, and others have said that he was riding a blue mountain bike. Now, police did find a few people who they thought could be the guy, but they were ultimately ruled out. While Blaylock does have that Texas conviction of sexually assaulting a child at knife point, to me, a man trying to molest an 11-year-old girl 8 days before Mikkel's disappearance is a bigger connection than Blaylock attacking an adult neighbor 10 months after Mikkel's disappearance.
So I would agree with you, except for the fact that if this person is a transient and he doesn't have a car, how did he snatch Mikayla?
Yeah, and that's a good question. So we don't know that he didn't have a car. I mean, there was no car reported in the initial attack. You know, some reports did place him with other people.
So maybe somebody else had the car.
Yeah, there is a possibility. A couple of weekends ago, I watched the docuseries on the Yogurt Shop murders on HBO, and this made me think of that because that case remained unsolved for decades. And over the years, police looked at people who were close to the victims or who had committed other crimes in the area. But the real killer turned out to be a transient serial killer who came through Texas, committed those murders, and left. He was only identified decades later through DNA.
Hmm.
Now, that was a murder of several people, so there was, you know, actual DNA available in that case. But in this one, what Mesa police do still have is the bicycle. Kimber's bike is still sitting in an evidence locker even after all of this time. And I can't help but wonder if there's still any possibility that the key to all of this is right there. I mean, maybe through something as simple as touch DNA.
Mm-hmm.
If Mikkel was on her bike, which is where she was the last time Kimber saw her, she was just kind of riding in circles in the street.
Waiting for the ice cream truck.
If this man came and grabbed the bike,
mm-hmm.
either causing her to fall off or he grabbed it and then she tried to run and then he grabbed her, however that may have worked, there's a possibility that there's some sort of touch DNA from the man on that bicycle. And in 1999,
that technology didn't exist.
Yeah, it just wasn't
right
at all where it is now.
Yeah.
I just don't know, you know. But in terms of physical evidence, That bike is really all you have in this case.
Right.
On the 5-year anniversary, in January 2004, the Biggs family did something incredibly difficult. They held a funeral for Mikkel with an empty white casket and purple flowers, because purple was her favorite color. Tracy said afterward, quote, "I believe we had spiritual closure," end quote. They had accepted that their daughter was almost certainly not coming home alive, even though they've never been able to bury her. Then, there was a strange and awful episode in 2018. A dollar bill turned up in Neenah, Wisconsin, with a message scrawled on it that read, "My name is Mikkel Biggs, kidnapped from Mesa AZ. I'm alive." It made national news for a minute, and you can imagine what it did to this family's heart. But it was quickly determined to be a hoax. The name was misspelled, the bill was from 2009, and it just couldn't be traced to anything. It was just somebody being profoundly cruel for attention or whatever reason.
Yeah, that's horrible.
So I don't know. I mean, like I said, in 2024, police said that Dee Blaylock is the person of interest. The person who attacked the other little girls seems to have kind of fallen by the wayside over the years. I don't know. I mean, obviously the father was looked into and then cleared, but those are kind of like the three scenarios, really.
Yeah.
This isn't one where there could be like many other things that happened, like she went off to start a new life or,
no,
you know,
I mean, she was definitely kidnapped.
Yeah, she was definitely abducted. Like, right. She was kidnapped.
Yeah.
But by whom?
I mean, to me, I said it even before Dee Blaylock came up, you know, it makes sense if somebody was surveilling her, watching her, whatever, and took the opportunity when she was alone to snatch her.
Yeah.
And I mean, he fits the bill. The transient, also a good possibility. But again, I go back to him potentially not having a vehicle, or if he did, it goes back to the same thing. Like, no neighbors saw anything out of the ordinary, like an unusual vehicle.
Right.
Like sitting in their neighborhood, you know?
Yeah. And this is a neighborhood where everybody knew everyone.
Right. Which is potentially another reason why Dee Blaylock might have been able to get close enough to her without raising any suspicions or whatever.
Yeah.
To snatch and grab her.
And because she could have, if not known him, at least recognized him,
right,
from around the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And yeah, because there were enough people around that you would think if she had enough time to scream that it would have been heard by somebody.
Right.
And it's just so hard. And, you know, I have this problem in general because it's like I always want to try to find a rational explanation. But in these cases, like, these are people doing completely irrational acts, right? I mean, right, somebody who's going to snatch a little girl off the street is not a rational person.
No.
So, you know, to me, I can't say, well, if he did it, you know, why didn't he just tell police what he did with her or whatever? You know what I mean? Like it's hard for me to wrap my mind around it, but I have to understand that that's just not how these people think.
Right.
Yeah. And I guess it really could come down to something as simple as, you know, kind of like what you're saying, where he was going to go to prison either way. It might be easier for him to go to prison for raping a grown woman.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Than raping a child.
Yeah,
because
child
he'd already,
rapists in prison do not get treated well by the other inmates.
Right, and he had already been in prison for that, right?
Right.
So he had firsthand experience.
Right.
So, I mean, I can see that. It's just, this happens to me with all these cases where it's been decades, right? Where it's just like, oh, my God, it's been 30 years. Like, why won't you just say something? But, you know, if you're going to do this to a child in the first place, I don't think you have a lot of empathy for a family who's just going through the hell of not having answers.
Right.
Now, before we close this out, I want to talk a little bit about Mikkel's sister, Kimber. She was the last person to see Mikkel, and her entire life has been shaped by what happened that January evening when she was 9. But I mentioned at the top of the episode that she's become Mikkel's biggest advocate, and she's turned this traumatic event into purpose. She runs a Justice for Mikkel Biggs Facebook page that tens of thousands of people follow. And in the last few years, she's gone professional with it. She now works with a national criminal justice training organization, teaching investigators how to work with the families of missing people.
That's huge. I mean, we've said this many times on this show, like, that there is no training for a missing person.
Yeah, and there's certainly no training about how to just deal with the families.
Right, and oftentimes that's where the investigation goes awry.
Yeah.
Because they start butting heads with the family mm-hmm. instead of keeping them close.
Right. So she was able to take the worst day of her childhood and turn it into a career helping other families survive their own worst days. The family is also working on a documentary about Mikkel's case with Kimber on the production team. And in a 2026 interview, she summed up where things stand for people who loved Mikkel, saying, quote, "If she has passed, I want to know how she passed. And if she is alive, I need to know where she's been this whole time," end quote. As for Mikkel's parents, Darian and Tracy did eventually divorce. Darian remarried and Tracy moved to Utah before eventually moving across the country to Saratoga Springs, New York. Both of them have said on the record that they believe Dealey Blaylock took their daughter. Tracy still marks Mikkel's birthday and the anniversary of her disappearance every year with purple flowers and a purple candle. I don't know whether Dee Blaylock took Mikkel, but his actions have had a lasting impact on not only his case, but on the lives of his victims. In the decade after her attack, Susan Quinette developed a drug problem and her life went downhill. She had been Mikkel's piano teacher. But in 2010, while on a combination of Ambien, Klonopin, and Prozac, she fatally shot her boyfriend after saying he had been pushing her emotional buttons all day. She served about 12 years in prison for second-degree murder and was released in 2024.
Jesus Christ. That's wild.
Isn't that insane? I came across that completely accidentally, too, because I was Googling her name just to hopefully quickly find an article to find out like what the exact charges were against Blaylock.
And then you found that.
I found her inmate record.
Damn.
And I was like, wait, what? And, you know, Susan Quinette is like not a super common name.
Right.
And it was in Arizona. And I was like, wait. So I, you know, did some more Googling and found out, yeah, that was indeed her. So like I said, she was released in 2024. Blaylock is still in prison and as of December 2025 had been working with the chaplain service.
Creepy.
On January 2nd, 1999, an 11-year-old girl sat on her little sister's new bike on a Saturday evening waiting for the ice cream truck. It was the most ordinary, innocent thing in the world, and it was the last completely ordinary moment of Mikkel Biggs' life. Her sister went inside for 90 seconds, and that's all the time the world needed to take Mikkel and never give her back. It's been 27 years since that day. Nearly three decades later, and the 10,000 tips, the 800 pieces of evidence, the empty casket, the named suspect sitting in a prison cell, still haven't given her family the one thing they have wanted since January 2nd, 1999. They just want to bring Mikkel home. Mikkel Biggs has been missing from Mesa, Arizona since January 2nd, 1999. She is a white female with brown hair and hazel eyes. At the time of her disappearance, she was approximately 4 feet 8 inches tall and 85 pounds. She had prominent upper front teeth, pierced ears, and several small moles on the left side of her neck. She was last seen wearing a red short-sleeve t-shirt with white stripe, embroidered bell-bottom blue jeans, and white canvas shoes. Mikkel was 11 years old when she went missing. She would be 39 today. If you have any information about the disappearance of Mikkel Biggs, please contact the Mesa Police Department Homicide Unit at 480-644-6195 or by email at p20008@mesaaz.gov. You can also leave an anonymous tip with Silent Witness at 480-WITNESS. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!